retail?
Yeah.
Well, welcome everybody to the April 20th, 2015 session of the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation. We got a full agenda today, and I see Senator Roblin's here. Senator Roblin, I'm here. You're here on 9/24. So we will.
Yep.
Nine which?
9/34.
9/34. Well, that's what I said 34, right?
24.
I said 24? Well, we're starting again.
You're the boss.
We're starting
you said
again.
Whatever you said.
We will open a work session on Senate Bill 9/34. You're up, James.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, Senate Bill 9/34 places limitation on state liability for non-property claims applicable to state fair counsel, exempts counsel from certain statutory provisions regarding the State Commission for the Blind, increases number of available seats on the council from 7 to 11 to 9 to 13, provides for the appointment of additional member of legislative to be non-voting observer and advisor to council. We have no revenue impact and no fiscal impact on the original measure. We also have a -1 amendment, removes exemption for state fair counsel regarding vending program. There is no revenue impact and no fiscal impact with that -1 amendment.
Great. Senator Roblin, welcome again.
Thank you, Chair Beyer and committee. For the record, Senate District 5 Senator Arnie Roblin. Thanks for hearing us again. You had a hearing last week, and we heard from our people from the Commission on the Blind and one of the people who works with the vending programs. We had a meeting last week, and my office agreed that we would remove that section and that they agreed in context to continue to do what they've been doing, which is just the vending machines. We were concerned because of the broad scope of that bill that it could have meant other things, and that we will work on negotiating contracts over the next year to figure out where we're at the end of the year. We believe that will work out for everybody.
Great.
Don't have much to add. It's an agreement, so we're ready to have this pass on if possible.
And your name?
Any questions?
Or Gene Durfee?
-1.
It's the -1.
-1. Take care.
Yep.
All righty. Any questions of these gentlemen? Guess not. I see we have some people here from the Blind Commission who had concerns last time. Did the amendment take care of your concerns?
We are happy.
You're happy. All righty.
Good.
Sounds like we're on ready to roll then. Chair moves the -1 amendments to Senate Bill 9/34. Discussion on the motion.
Did you open a work session?
I did.
Oh, thank you.
This is a work session day. We're moving bills. It's our last day on them. Any discussion? Seeing none, is there any opposition? The -1 amendments to 9/34 are adopted. Chair moves Senate Bill 9/34. Does this have to go to Ways and Means?
No.
It does not. To the floor with a do pass recommendation. Question or discussion on that motion? Is there any opposition to the motion? Senate Bill 9/34 is moved to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation. Senator Roblin, do you wish to carry?
I would be glad to. Honor.
We will. We are closed on 9/34. We'll go back up to the top. We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 275.
Mr. Chairman, committee members.
Thank you.
Senate Bill 275. We've heard this bill back in March and was on the agenda and earlier in April as well. Requires mortgage loan services to obtain license or endorsement and requires other persons that engage in business as mortgage loan services to obtain endorsement. Specifies considerations Director of Department of Consumer and Business Services may use in deciding whether to issue license or endorsement. Requires applicant for license or endorsement to file corporate surety bonds or irrevocable letter of credit with and to provide proof of financial responsibility to director and to notify director of certain changes to mortgage loan services operations or governance. Subjects mortgage loan services books and records to director's examination or examination that Conference of State Bank Supervisors conducts, permits director to take temporary possession and control or to direct sale of mortgage loan services assets in certain circumstances, requires mortgage loan servicer to maintain escrow account for funds from borrowers in this state and directs mortgage loan servicer to segregate funds and escrow account from all mortgage loan servicers' other funds, prohibits certain practices and otherwise subjects mortgage loan services to regulations of similar nature and extent as regulations to which mortgage bankers and mortgage brokers are subject, establishes exemptions for charter banks and credit unions and an endorsement process for other other financial institutions licensed by the department. Becomes operative January 1st, 2016. Declares emergency effective on passage. We have four amendments with Senate Bill 275. The first amendment eliminates the ability to take possession of property and affairs of mortgage loan of servicer and replaces with an ability to go to court and ask for the appointment of a receiver and modifies trust reference. There is no revenue impact and there is a fiscal impact with that amendment. On the Dash 2 amendment, defines persons holding a consumer finance license under Chapter 725 or a mortgage broker or broker license under Chapter 86A as not a mortgage loan servicer. There is no revenue impact and a fiscal impact with the Dash 2. The Dash 3 amendment provides exemption for mortgage servicer that services loan for a period of not more than 90 days or until the person sells the mortgage loan. Creates exemption for mortgage loan servicer who services not more than 100 of the mortgage loans the person originates. Removes exemption for a licensor and applicant who is not subject to ORS 86A.227 to file a corporate surety bond or irrevocable letter of credit that is approved by director. Provides flexibility to a director to adjust the amount of corporate surety bond for a licensor. Eliminates the ability to take possession of a property and affairs of mortgage loan servicer and places one the ability to go to court and ask for the appointment of a receiver. Modifies trustee reference. No revenue impact, and there's a fiscal impact with the Dash 3 amendment. And the last amendment, the Dash 4 amendment, exempts Oregon Department of Veteran Affairs and state agencies and federal agencies from the definition of mortgage loan servicer. No revenue impact, and there's a fiscal impact with the Dash 4.
All right. We'll start off with Lori Skillman.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lori Skillman. Excuse me. I'm a senior policy advisor for the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. As you know, the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs originates loans and services loans and has been doing so for veterans for the past 70 years. With this provision, currently, ODVA is exempt from the definition of mortgage banker, and we want the same exemption to flow through to mortgage loan servicers. So the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs would not need to get a license. The language that's proposed in the Dash 4 amendments parallels the language that currently exists for the exemptions for mortgage banker. If you have any questions, I'm happy to answer.
Simple
them.
Enough, takes the vets out. Any questions? Don't see any. Thank you very much. Mr. Cosgrove.
He's testifying in another committee, so he went to get him. It's not my bill.
Okay. Well, in the meantime, David, you want to come up and address?
Yes, can I have Blake bring this to Blackwell?
You sure can. We've been through this enough, so we need to help us understand which of the amendments you support and oppose and why.
Mr. Chair, thank you. For the record, David Tapman, and with me is Rick Blackwell. I'm the administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities as part of DCBS, Department of Consumer Business Services. Mr. Blackwell is our legislative coordinator within the division. So you have four amendments in front of you. The fourth one you just heard about from Ms. Skillman. That would have the agency, the Department of Veterans Affairs, take care of these matters. As we've said all along, we're looking for some place for consumers to be able to register complaints and have redress. That would clearly take care of that, so we have, we're fully supportive of the Dash 4s. The Dash 1s, for the most part, are cleanups that make some minor changes that was done at our request to provide some clarification. It also creates what we think is a better method to address problems should a loan servicing company fall into trouble financially. We felt that the original proposal we had in 275 was too cumbersome, too enlarged, and too one-sided. It would give us too much authority one way to go in and ask to have one of these closed and us take possession. Instead, much like many of our other programs, our amendment would allow us to go to court, file a lawsuit, and ask a judge to step in and provide whatever redress the court thinks is appropriate. And we think that's a more balanced approach rather than the original bill. The Dash 2s, we think, go too far. They would exclude all the licensees that you've heard conversations from. Those would be both consumer finance lenders, mortgage banker brokers, mortgage bankers, and mortgage brokers. We think that that would not allow sufficient coverage. Just to remind the committee, as we previously said, this is not a grab to try and create additional licenses or create additional fees. What we came up with was an endorsement process. So those that already had a license, both consumer finance, mortgage banker, mortgage broker, would be subject to obtaining that endorsement. We don't anticipate an additional cost for that, but it would allow us to establish certain standards that we want to use across all mortgage loan servicers, including certain capital reserves and certain other requirements for books and records, as well as a surety bond increase if necessary. And then the dash threes is our other proposal, and that comes in to address the questions that Mr. Marquis and Mr. Cosgrove brought up at the original hearing. And one was the issue around mortgage brokers who oftentimes will make a loan fully intending to sell that loan, but they may not have a buyer in place immediately. So we agreed that it made sense to give them a 90-day window of time so they don't have to get a license. We don't want to license somebody for a less than 90-day period of time. It doesn't make sense to us. So we would create a carve-out for them so that if you've sold the particular loan within 90 days or less, then you wouldn't have to get licensed. And that's what we understood was the business model that Mr. Marquis raised. Similarly, Mr. Cosgrove talked about what he labeled as his mom-and-pop consumer finance lenders, people that are small consumer finance lenders, do not engage in a nationwide scope of business, and having them have a carve-out. So we took a look at the number of loans what we were seeing that the smaller entities did, and we did some kind of math, and we came up with if they made 100 or less such loans, then we would give them a carve-out as well. So our goal was, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, was to meet the concerns that we heard halfway and trying to address them, but still ensure that we have the consumer protections that we think are necessary, will bring us in place with the other 25-some states that engage in this practice of loan servicing, and to make sure that we have certain practices that provide protections when necessary so we avoid the problems we had in 2008 through 2011.
Okay, so I want to be clear. So does your dash threes incorporate the dash one cleanup?
Mr. Chair, I'm not certain of that. I took a look at that, and I thought there were some places where they did not overlap. In fact, the dash threes, I'm not positive, but I'll defer to Mr. Blackwell, who probably helped work with them in legislative council.
Chair Byron, members of the committee, Rick Blackwell with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. The dash threes were meant to incorporate all of the changes that we had proposed in the ones plus this exemption that Mr. Tapman had discussed earlier. The only thing that I can see that seems to be off is there's a couple of word keeping, like just kind of housekeeping measures that didn't get in, which should be addressed at least in the in the House side. There's a reference to trustees that was supposed to be in there and does not appear to have made it into the dash three. So the differences are very minor.
Okay, so I need your help to make sure if we were choosing to move this, which of the amendments are you suggesting are necessary? Because you said the 2 is 2-4, so it would be the 1, 3, and 4?
That would be our recommendation, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, although, as you heard from Mr. Blackwell, 4 and 3 for sure, and 1's probably just some cleanup we could do on the backside.
So, in essence, what you're trying to do here is you already have authority to regulate the mortgage brokers and mortgage financiers. But if I recall your question, you said you do not have authority over third-party servicers.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's right. In fact, expressly stated in Chapter 86A, it says we do not have authority over mortgage bankers, mortgage brokers in terms of loan servicing.
So, but your clear target is the people who are just servicers or are not one of the others?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch the last word.
There are, my memory of this, and please correct me if I'm wrong, there is a small group of businesses that have sprung up after the banking reforms that do nothing but servicing?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's correct. There are,
and those are the people you have no
number, but there are a number that have popped up with the changes under Dodd-Frank.
And those are the ones you have no control over now.
Correct. Okay. But again, to reemphasize, we don't have the authority over our mortgage bankers or mortgage brokers with respect to loan servicing conduct. So once this loan is made and sold, we don't have the jurisdiction over them.
So if there's a problem, I know we ran into this a lot with the foreclosures and that, where people were not getting notified. You wouldn't have the authority to intercede on the consumer's behalf?
Mr. Chair, that would be a challenge for us to do as much if they don't have a loan servicing license. You heard testimony from one of the individual consumers. I think she was a professor from Linfield College, you may recall, and she had a situation where, through no fault of her own, her payments weren't getting credited to her. The company was licensed with us, but they were ignoring everything until we finally talked to them about their license and then explained to them they needed to make changes. That's not the best way for consumers to get redress.
Hmm. Okay. Senator Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand the carve-out for 90 days. That makes perfect sense to me. The under 100, I'm not quite so sure that makes sense to me. Just because you only service a few loans doesn't mean you can't be a bad actor.
Mr. Chair, Senator Riley, I agree. That's a problem. This was an attempt to try and find some middle ground, and we recognize exactly your concerns. And in fact, in some instances, they may have less expertise than a larger enterprise. So that's a valid concern. And I think what we're going to do is try this and figure out, try and establish some outline of borders, and then figure out where we need to go from here. This is a chance to try and get the bill through and start the process.
Follow up, please.
Please.
So have you done any research to see if your complaints that come in are
another try
on greater than 100 or less than 100? Do we know where those complaints are?
Mr. Chair and Senator Riley, we don't have the information per se, but what we have seen is we have seen a significant number of complaints about some of the bigger companies we told you about. And I think that may be a reflection on just the sheer volume of the work they do. It may not be a per capita. I can't draw that relationship. But, for instance, Ocwen, the biggest of all the ones we're talking about as a loan servicer, has a lion's share of the complaints here in Oregon.
Thank you.
Others? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Markey, did you want to comment at all?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Matt Markey on behalf of the Mortgage Bankers Association. The only thing I would say, we are in favor of the Dash 2 amendments. What we have stressed with the department in the couple of meetings that we did have since the last hearing is, why wouldn't we just work through the existing licensure statutes around mortgage banking and as did Mr. Cosgrove, around the consumer finance companies, and work within that and change what's necessary within the licensing statute if there are changes needed to address it there rather than a separate certification. That's why we were seeking the exemption. There are a lot of, and I'm not an expert, but there are a lot of federal guidelines around servicing what can and can't be done. There are audits that take place with my mortgage bankers as well from that standpoint. We feel the Dash 2s could move in that direction, and we were just hopeful that that's where the department would end up as well.
It sounds like they made a lot of movement, though. I mean, they moved off of a separate license.
It's an endorsement, and that's how I think it was in the bill originally. If you were one of these other items, if you're a mortgage banker, for instance, like Senator Riley just mentioned, I find it a little odd that if I am a mortgage banker, for instance, and I originate 100 loans and keep them and service them, I'm okay. But if I do 105, I'm not, and I'm not sure what the difference there is. In the first hearing, they talked a lot about the financial solvency of a company, and I would guess that a smaller company is, or potentially could be, less solvent than a larger company.
But I thought that's what you asked for.
I asked for the 90 days is what I had asked for originally. Yes, and that is a problem with the mortgage banker. They did address that concern. I can't say that they didn't.
All right. Any questions, Matt? I'm going to recess this until Mr. Cosgrove isn't back yet, is he? I'm going to give him a chance to comment before we decide whether we're going to act on it or not. So we will recess on Senate Bill 275. Circle that. And we will, let's see, we will open a work session on Senate Bill 271. We've work session all these, haven't we?
Right. We're holding off on 271 a little bit.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. I'm sorry. I have to close. We're waiting for a fiscal statement. That's the one for that. So we'll move on down to Senate Bill 751.
And open a
Senate Bill 751. Mr. Chair and committee, we have also heard this bill before, earlier in the month. It establishes an organ donor registry and public awareness fund in state treasury as a separate and distinct from general fund. Directs Oregon Department of Transportation.
That's me.
Your phone?
Dude, that's $25.
To accept donations at $3 or more for the rule. Fund. Adds a checkbox to driver permit, license, and ID card applications and renewals, as well as a as to online vehicle registration renewals, requires ODOT to transfer the monies in the fund after deducting expenses for collecting and transferring to the Oregon Procurement Organization that has established a donor registry in the state for the purpose of conducting statewide outreach and public education related to anatomical gifts. We have a dash 5 amendment. It's the latest amendment. It adds context statements regarding organ donations to measure. It requires ODOT to maintain on its vehicle registration renewal website and online application form a link to the website of the Oregon Procurement Organization that established a donor registry in the state for the purpose of redirecting the person to a website that accepts donations into the fund. Declares operative day for department accepting donations as early as July 1st, 2019. There's a revenue light statement and a fiscal light statement, and this needs to have a subsequent referral to Joint Ways and Means.
Okay. Committee, I don't think we need anything else. So which amendments do we need?
Dash 5.
Do you want to move the dash 5s?
Yeah, I'll move the dash 5s.
Senator Girard has moved the dash 5 amendments to Senate Bill 751. Discussion on that motion? Senator Riley?
Thank you. Just to clarify for my, does this take out the requirement for the DMV to actually take the donations, or does it?
Yes.
It was in place after 2019.
After 2019?
That's okay. When, that's the date when their computer system is supposed to be fully up to
and
date.
It gives us time to take it out.
Yep.
Okay. We may not make Amy happy, but.
Well, she's got time to come back and talk to us later.
Yeah. Anything else? Okay, is there any opposition to the dash 1 amendments?
Five
amendments. Dash 5 amendments. Okay. Move it to Ways and Means.
Mm-hmm.
So the dash 5s are adopted. Senator Girard?
I move Senate Bill 751 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to Joint Ways and Means.
Senator Girard has moved Senate Bill 751 as amended by the dash 5s to the floor with a due pass with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Discussion on that motion. Is there any opposition to that motion? The motion is adopted. So we'll close on that, and Mr. Cosgrove's here, so we're going to reopen on Senate Bill 275. Paul, come on up, Paul. Paul, while you were out, we had a comment from Matt and from the department. The department's, oh, and we also had the vets, the dash fours, if we adopt it, to exclude them. The department's recommendation is the dash ones and the dash threes. You're on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul Cosgrove representing Oregon Financial Service Association, and I very much appreciate the courtesy in allowing me to make a few brief comments out of order. When we were here with the hearing, we were in support of the Dash 2s, and the rationale is the consumer finance companies in this state have been licensed for many years by DCBS. There's a whole chapter of ORS, and a whole division of the OARs that regulate our lending. It includes such things as how we keep our loan files, where we keep our servicing files. We are examined by the department. We are audited by the department. We have to pay fees, and we have to be bonded. If there were a concern about how we service these kinds of loans, we would have expected that it be dealt with under our licensing statute and the rulemaking authority, which the department has, which is very broad. The reason we don't think there is a concern to do that is, in fact, when we invite the department staff to come to our annual meeting every fall, we always talk about both exam results for the industry as a whole and complaints. And the people who actually do those exams and hear those complaints know that this industry is actually very clean, very low complaint level, and very high exam ratings. So our concern is not to be subjected to a new regulatory scheme with its different requirements, additional bonding requirements, where there doesn't seem to be any need to do so, in that if there is a problem, it can be addressed by the department under our own licensing statute and rules. If you adopt the Dash 2, what you're doing is exempting the consumer finance companies and the mortgage bankers who are in the same situation with their own licensing and regulatory provisions within the department from this additional requirement. But the department can certainly deal with any servicing issues that they wish through their own regulatory statutes that are already in place. So we're just asking for elimination of duplication and allowing us to have, if there's going to be a rulemaking, we're happy to come, listen to whatever problems and address them. That's what we've always done with the department. So we would prefer that the committee adopt the Dash 2. No comment about the Dash 4. That's certainly fine. If DVA needs to be exempted, that's fine. And the Dash 1, as I understand, has been described as a cleanup, and we agree that makes sense at the Dash 1 as well. Thank you.
I guess there's a difference of agreement between you and the department. The department apparently does not believe they have the authority to do that.
Mr. Chair, the department's rules have such details as where we keep our loan servicing files and when we move them from one office to another, what kind of notices we have to give to them. They come in and they look at these files. They make comments on these files. If they find problems, we correct those problems. They also have rules in existence about how we do refunds if there is a miscollection, how we apply payments to the accounts. Those are all aspects of servicing. They already have rules on that. These rules have been in existence for many years. The department has that authority, in fact, has been exercising that authority pretty consistently. And it's their own rules that have these provisions. I can cite them, but it's a whole a division of the rules, as well as a whole chapter of ORS.
David, could I get you to respond to that?
For the record again, David Tatman, Administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. Mr. Cosgrove is correct. I looked at the statute. All the statute, the ORS, tends to focus very much more so on the lending practices. The OAR, the Oregon Administrative Rules, has a fair amount about the servicing components. We do not disagree. Our concern would be, should we make them more robust? Because I would like to have a parallel process, because we don't address this under mortgage banking and brokering. I'd like to make sure we're consistent across all fronts, and I just would want some assurance that Mr. Cosgrove would agree that we could continue to build the focus on servicing where historically the focus has been on lending.
And if I may respond, we have absolutely no disagreement. We periodically sit down with the department and talk about updates in our rules that we think are needed, and they sometimes bring provisions to us that they think are needed, and we're happy to have that conversation. But then it'll be done in consistent with our existing statutes and existing rules rather than this whole new separate thing. That's our concern.
Thank you both.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Before you leave, does anybody have questions?
Yes.
Senator Thompson?
So if we go with this method, is it the Dash 1, the Dash, how would we get there?
The Dash 1s, Dash 2s, and Dash 4s.
Correct.
Is what
and the one,
Mr. Cosgrove
one, two,
suggested.
And four?
Yeah.
Correct.
Or vote no.
I don't know in general, I guess.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I just want to put on the record again that, as we said all along, there was no provision similar to what Mr. Cosgrove's laid out for mortgage bankers and brokers because of the prohibition. So we would be starting with a clean sheet, if you will, in that area. And our hope would be that we would incorporate similar standards or similar practices. But that's something down the road should the bill pass.
And I want to make sure, clarify this also. Currently,
you still there's a gap in between the bankers of one flavor or another and the servicers who are not also bankers.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Which is a big number now. I mean, there's
right, and our amendment does not affect the ability of the department to deal with people who are currently not licensed under any of their licensing schemes. That would still be there. They could do all of those rules. This just means that under the people they already license, they'd be using their current licensing statutes and current rulemaking authority if they thought there were gaps.
Great. More? No. Anybody else? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Well, colleagues, given that this is the last day, I think there is a need for the basic bill. I mean, there is that middle that isn't covered, I believe, for the protection of Oregonians. It's my feeling. I think that we probably need to pass a bill, and it needs to include at least the dash ones and the dash fours. And then I guess it's a dispute between the twos and the threes.
Threes, there was no dispute.
Huh?
The threes, there was no dispute.
True. Well, maybe that's it.
Yeah.
Okay. Maybe. Actually, I think the threes do. I think they do have trouble with the threes.
Oh.
They do.
Okay.
We don't have time to work this any farther. The House, maybe this may be one that there's something that I don't like, because I suggest we pass what we can and let them take it up on the House side.
Why don't we refer it to rules? It stays alive down there, then they can go fight it out down there.
We can't put everything in rules. So, I'm going to do the easy stuff. The chair moves the dash one amendments to House Bill 275. Discussion on that motion? Is there any opposition to that motion? The dash ones are adopted. The chair moves House or the dash four amendments to Senate Bill 275. Is there discussion on that? Is there any opposition on that? The dash fours are adopted. Now here comes the hard part. The chair moves the dash three amendments to Senate Bill 275. And discussion?
Opposed?
Senator Gerard's opposed. Senator Thompson's opposed. So anybody else? So the dash threes are adopted. The chair moves Senate Bill, 275 to the Senate, to Ways and Means, right?
No. Because, no.
Senate floor.
Yep.
Okay. Isn't there a fiscal?
There are fiscal impacts, but it has no subsequent referral. Unless we'd like to add one.
I think there needs to be one.
Okay.
The Ways and Means chair asked me to send it to him.
Okay.
So, again, the chair moves Senate Bill 275 as amended to the Senate floor, but they do pass with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Want to change it to no recommendation?
No. No, I don't. I do think there is a need for it. I think we probably better call the roll on this one. Is there discussion before we call the roll? Call the roll, please.
Senator Monroe?
Aye.
Senator Thompson?
Nope.
Senator Riley?
Aye.
Vice Chair Drodd?
No.
Chair Beyer?
Aye. Senate Bill 275, as amended, is moved to the floor with a duplass with a subsequent to Ways and Means. We'll close on that one and give you guys a chance to work it a little farther. Let's see. Now we got that one done. Are we ready for 271 yet?
Not yet.
Waiting. Not yet. So we'll go down to... We're going to move 286 to the...
886.
Okay, we're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 886. Colleagues, this one has a whole lot more work that needs to be done, so the chair moves Senate Bill 886 to the Rules Committee.
Oh, I like it.
Discussion? Is there any opposition? Senate Bill 886 moves to the Rules Committee. We'll close on that one. We did 934. Are we ready for 589? So we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 596.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 596. We have also heard in committee earlier this session. It directs Contractors Board to create a construction flagging contractor license available that will require the contractor to be bonded and carry insurance. Specifies that the flagging contractor licensee does not authorize licensee to engage in work of general contractor or other subcontractor. There is a dash one amendment. It changes effective date from no later than 180 days after passage to July 1st, 2017. On that dash one amendment, there is no revenue impact and there is a minimal fiscal impact.
And the chair moves the dash ones to Senate Bill 596. Discussion? Is there any opposition? Dash ones are adopted. Chair moves Senate Bill 596 to the Senate floor, but they do pass. Discussion?
I'm going to be opposed.
Again? You're on a roll here.
Today's going to be a roll day.
Your neighbor in the caucus who's in this business liked this bill. Other than that.
Well, to me, it's a barrier of entry. I just have to tell you. And I, if somebody has a small gravel business or something and they put a flagger out there, I don't see any reason why they have to go through these requirements. So I just think it's a barrier of entry, and I think it impacts the smaller contractors.
I don't think it's intended with those, but I appreciate that. Further discussion? Let's see. So did we have a motion on?
We do.
We do have. So I guess we'll call that again.
Senator Monroe.
Aye.
Senator Thompson.
Nope.
Senator Riley.
Aye.
Vice Chair Drott.
No.
Chair Byer.
Aye. And I guess I'll carry it.
God, you're on a roll because the next three are no's.
Okay. So we'll close on 596 and we'll open a work session on, let's see, what are we doing
878.
Here?
878.
Senate Bill 878.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 878. Changes requirements for operating moped or motorcycle by allowing person to stand or stand astride while operating moped or motorcycle. Declares changes to ORS 814-200 with this act only applies to offenses committed on or after the effective date of this 2015 act. There is no revenue impact and there is no fiscal impact. Thank you.
And I guess I will invite up Ethan. Is that Locke? Ludwig?
Yes, sir.
Got it right.
Mr. Chair.
Welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ethan Ludwig. I'm from Eugene, Oregon. I've been a motorcycle enthusiast for about 30 years, and about 2 years ago, a friend of mine told me a story where he had recently been riding over a speed bump and got pulled over and was told that was illegal to stand up as he went over the speed bump, and he was checked for everything and let go, no other offenses. So we found out that standing up is illegal in Oregon. If you've ever ridden a motorcycle or bicycle, you may notice that you have a lot more control if you stand up going over obstacles. And in fact, the Motorcycle Handbook of Oregon, California, Nevada, and multiple other states advise you to stand up as you're going over obstacles. ORS 814-200 says that's illegal. So I'm simply here to try to eliminate that incongruity. I can read 814-200 for you, but it basically says that you get a Class B traffic violation if you fail to sit on a permanent and regular seat attached to the moped or motorcycle. And the quote from the Motorcycle Handbook says to rise slightly off the seat with your weight on the foot pegs to absorb the shock with your knees and elbows. This will help you from being thrown off the motorcycle. Some people may be concerned about people being allowed to stand up on a motorcycle, but it really avoids accidents. A lot of people come to this state touring on dual sport motorcycles, which is something I enjoy, where you're riding on many of our dirt roads. They enjoy camping and being out. They come from all over to do that. And frequently you stand up as you go over those rough roads. So, again, just sort of a housekeeping thing.
Senator Drott?
Well, I agree with your right to stand up over a speed bump or grate, but that's not what the bill says. It allows you to stand up all the time. So we could be going down the freeway and somebody is driving standing up on a motorcycle going down the freeway the way this is written. So that's the problem that I have. I understand where you're coming from, but the bill is so inclusive it allows you to stand up all the time.
It's uncomfortable to stand up on the freeway because of the wind, frankly. As it would be difficult to define what constitutes an obstacle that I would like to stand up over in order to have more control on the motorcycle. And this essentially allows it to be up to the driver of the motorcycle. Also, cruisers, if you've seen the Harley-Davidson laid-back cruisers where your feet are way out in front of you, you wouldn't want to mandate that they stand up either, over obstacles.
I would never mandate, but
I'm just
you could
saying.
Say that under these circumstances, you could stand up on your motorbike, speed bumps, grates. Those are the two I could think of.
Senator Riley?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My understanding of the reason that we had this bill in the first place, and I could be wrong, but this is what I've understood, that this was designed to keep people from standing on the seat because there were people who were riding on the road standing on the seat showing off, if you get my drift.
Mm-hmm.
And this bill was designed to stop that.
The
original bill.
Okay.
Not this bill, but
where this came from. But.
Yeah.
Other questions?
Do you want to respond to that?
Yes, I'm sorry. I'm being out of order. I'm not very good at this. Mr. Chair, Senator Riley, currently also in state law, same 814-200 mandates that you stand astride the motorcycle. So this would you would still be in violation of 814-200 if you were not if you didn't have.
Thank you.
Yes, and there are multiple laws that prohibit reckless driving, showmanship, things like that. Speeding.
Okay.
And again, regardless of the speed, standing up lowers your center of gravity, allows you to move on the motorcycle. If there was a large obstacle, even on the freeway, it would be in the best interest of that motorcycle rider to, just as the language points out in the rider safety manual, slow down prior to hitting the obstacle, a broom or a pipe or anything else, let go of the brakes, stand up, unweight the front wheel, go over the obstacle, and recover. If you sit down over an obstacle, regardless of whether it's on the freeway or anywhere else, you have a higher chance of losing control.
I'm fine.
You okay? Any other questions? Thank you, sir.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Amy, do you want to comment at all?
No.
Okay. All right.
Mr. Chair?
Have a bill in front of Senator Monroe.
Yeah, I'd really like to hear from traffic safety people as to whether this is in some way a greater danger.
Okay.
May I approach?
Well,
why don't you let her?
Oh, yes.
Please.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation, today representing our Transportation Safety Division. We have absolutely no safety concerns about the bill.
No safety concerns.
None.
Okay. Okay. Cool.
Thank you.
Any more? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, colleagues, we have a bill in front of us. Someone want to make a motion?
I move we send this bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Riley has moved that Senate bill, got to get my right one down here, 878 be moved to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on that motion?
I'm going to be a no, but I might change to a yes if I get convinced that it shouldn't be tightened down. I just think the language is way too loose in the bill.
Okay. Does anybody else have a comment? Anybody else opposed? All righty. Senate Bill 878. Did we have an amendment? We didn't.
Nope.
We didn't. Is moved to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Senator Girard is a no. Senator Riley, would you like to carry?
Sure.
We'll close on that, and we don't have.
I'm looking for Senator Bates.
Has he been notified? Do I wait,
so.
Or should we do the next one?
Do the next one.
Okay, we're going to, would you notify Senator Bates that we're going to about to do it? So we'll open on Senate Bill 948. James?
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 459 is also a bill we have heard in committee before. It increases interstate highway speed limit to 70 miles per hour for most vehicles.
So, excuse me, you opened 948.
Oh, 948, sorry. Did you want to do, so we had 495 and 459.
Oh, I went too far. Well.
Which one do you want to do? Sorry.
Did you just read 495?
I was reading 459.
Okay, so let me suspend on 948 and we'll open Senate Bill 459. And committee, I think that bill needs some work, and I'm going to recommend and move that we move Senate Bill 459 down to the Rules Committee. Well, it didn't do what we intended it to do, and we're not going to fix it between now and then, so we'll wait and see if we can do that. So we have a motion on the floor to move it to Rules. Discussion on that motion? Any opposition to the motion? We're closed on that. It is moved to Rules. So now we will reopen on 948.
I'm good. Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 948 is a bill we heard in committee before. It permits Department of Transportation to issue vehicle registration plates from regular series for use on county-owned vehicle rather than plates from specifically designed government series. Declares emergency effective on passage. We have a dash one amendment. Prohibits the use of one license plate for the cost of another license plate. There is minimal revenue impact and no fiscal impact with the dash one amendment.
Okay, the chair moves the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 948. Discussion on that motion. Senator Riley.
Could you clarify that just a little bit? You said, could you say what this amendment does again? Because I didn't follow that.
Sure. Prohibits the use of one license plate, example, the tree plate, which costs $86, for the cost of another plate, example, the government plate, which costs $3.
So can you?
I see.
You can
I
use
see.
The government plate.
I see. Thank you. Okay.
Any other discussion on that motion? Is there any opposition to the motion to approve the amendment? There is none, so that is approved. Chair moves Senate Bill 948 as amended by the dash ones to the floor with a DuPass floor, right?
Mm-hmm.
To the floor with the DuPass recommendation. Discussion on that motion.
I'm going to change my vote to be a yes. I hate to be all these no's. You know.
Were you? No. Well, we haven't voted on it, so we have nothing to change yet. So, a discussion on a motion. Is there any opposition to the motion?
Yeah, here.
You're opposed.
I got.
Oh, huh?
Somebody's got to do it. Fred.
Somebody's got to do it. Okay, so.
I thought it was a good bill.
As a former county commissioner, he's disagreeing with the other former county commissioner, Senator Hassel. All righty, so Senate Bill 948, as amended by the dash one, is moved to Senate to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Senator Thompson opposed. Senator Hansel will carry that. We have Senator Bates
here. Mr. Chair.
And we do have. So let's see.
Mr. Chair.
This is, yes?
Did we vote on the speed limit?
No.
We sent it to Rules.
Oh, we sent it to Rules. Okay.
We, if you'll recall last week when we heard it, we found out it didn't do what we were intending to do.
It was pretty good.
So we haven't figured out yet how to do what we intended to do. So we're going to open on Senate Bill 495.
Yeah, budget note for their budget.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 495 eliminates exception to safety belt laws that allow person to not use safety belts if all seating positions in vehicle are occupied. There is no revenue impact, no fiscal impact with this measure, and there are no amendments.
Senator Bates, welcome.
Thank you, Chair Byers, and hello, committee members. For the record, Alan Bates, Senate District 3 down in Southern Oregon. This issue was actually brought to me about 5 or 6 years ago as a result of a tragic accident that occurred in Southern Oregon. A mother was taking her teenage children and a couple of other kids around Applegate Lake from one side of the lake to the other. She had a Suburban and no alcohol, nothing involved, afternoon. The car was filled with kids, and each of them had seat belts on, but two of the kids in the very back had no seats to sit in. If you know about a Suburban, it has actually three rows of seats. But the last two were just left in the back because they weren't going very far, and she was running around the lake to get to the other side of the lake. Unfortunately, she lost control of the car. It went off the road and hit a tree, and the two kids in the back were ejected and both killed. There was no bad actors in this. This is a very nice woman, a wonderful family. One of the grandfathers brought this issue to me. And it's kind of languished on my desk. It's one of those things you think about, I should take care of it next time. I went out and talked to LC about it. They actually refer to it as the car clown bill, because this is the kind of thing that can happen. If you don't have clarity in the law about what's legal and illegal. So it's really about people putting, you know, adults or kids in a car that's designed for a certain number of people, that has seat belts and seats for everybody. But if you put extra people in right now, it's legal to do that. And the biggest, or one of the biggest ways people get killed in car accidents is by ejection from cars, and they get thrown in the car and die. So this bill closes that loophole. The way the bill is written is kind of confusing if you start reading it carefully. This is an exclusionary situation, so all the things you're reading about in the bill are things that are excluded. We're just eliminating one exclusion, and that exclusion is that if you've got a car that's not a commercial vehicle, it's not a school bus, but it's just a regular car or a Suburban, and you've got a certain number of seats in it, a certain number of seat belts in it, you really can't go past that and just stick some more people into it, hoping you don't have an accident. And that's all the bill does.
Does this cover sitting in the back of a pickup?
Yeah, strangely enough, my understanding from LC is the back of a pickup is already covered. You have to have seat belts in there unless you're moving from a small field to a small field at very slow speeds. This is for cars on the highway.
Senator Thompson?
Yeah, Senator Bates, I have a 1956 Ford Thunderbird. Didn't come with seat belts. They didn't make them, or they didn't come from the factory.
That is excluded.
Does this affect that?
Chair Byers and Senator Thompson, is my understanding that would be excluded if your car was built at a time that seat belts weren't required. You're not required under the law to do this.
Thank you.
But should.
Mr. Chair,
yeah.
Just a second. Were you done?
Yeah.
Senator Monroe?
I'm the author of the original child restraint law, and at that time we had to make compromises. This was one of the compromises. I'm glad you're undoing it. That's very important. And I'm also one of the authors of the original seatbelt law, and you're absolutely right in response to Senator Thompson. If you're driving an older vehicle that didn't have seatbelts as standard equipment, then you're not required to use seatbelts that aren't there.
Other questions?
I go.
Senator Rod?
Yeah, back to the farm exemption. You were saying that if you take a group from one field to another and they're in the back of a pickup truck, that they have to be seat belted in?
No, my understanding, I may be corrected by legal counsel here, my understanding is no. If you're out on the highway driving, law already requires you to be seat belted in. If you're just moving from field to field or doing low speed traveling between the farms, you don't have to do that. Someone who farmed for a long time, and I still worry about that sometimes. We had a case in Prospect where at 5 miles an hour somebody flipped out of the back of a pickup truck going across the field and hit their head and died on the spot. So it's still dangerous. But it's common practice. I've done it myself, picking up bales of hay, but this does not cover that. And that's still allowed.
Okay. Other questions? No? Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
Amy, is this one you want to comment on? Nope. Okay. Good to go. Kathy.
Katie, again. It's Katie.
Katie, excuse me. I always say that wrong. Katie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Beyer and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Katie King, and I'm here today representing OSEP, the Oregon chapter of the American College of Emergency Physicians. And OSEP supports this bill. Emergency physicians see firsthand the consequences of not wearing seatbelts. In 2009, more than 2.3 million adult drivers and passengers were treated in emergency rooms as a result of vehicle crashes. So here's what happens in a crash. At the moment of impact, people in the car are still traveling at the original speed. When the car rapidly comes to a stop, anyone not wearing a safety belt will continue to move at that speed until their body slams into the steering wheel, the windshield, perhaps other passengers, or worse, if they're ejected from the vehicle. In a 55-mile-per-hour crash, unbelted passengers of average size fly forward with the force of 3,000 pounds, enough to cause serious injury or death. Passengers in the back seat are just as vulnerable as those in the front. So safety belts provide the greatest protection against ejection in a crash, and as Senator Bates alluded to, it's a great cause. It's a cause of death as well. 75% of people ejected from a car during a crash are killed. So this bill will help save lives. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Questions? I hear a question.
I do. And the question is, like in Suburbans, like what he was saying, the question is how many Suburbans are going to, because the seats go in and out in a lot of them, so how many of those are going to be non-functional seats? I don't know the answer to that.
They'll have seat belts.
So, Mr. Chair and Vice Chair Girard, that sounds like a great question for ODOT.
Oh, GMB.
I see Senator Bates chomping at the bit here. I think any of them that are sold, new ones, I think by federal law, have to have a seat belt for each passenger position.
Yes.
But if you had an old one and it didn't have all of the positions covered, probably falls under Senator Thompson's comments about you only have to have them if they were originally there.
Senator Byers, for record, Alan Bates again, District 3, committee members. I've owned Suburban since the early 90s. They have always had the 3 series of seats. The third seat's always had seat belts in it. Some of them not shoulder seat belts, just lap seat belts. But again, it would fall under the category. If the car didn't originally come with them, you wouldn't be required to have them. But there's very few Suburbans left on the road that don't have them anymore for the third seat. The third seat does pull in and pull out, but they're really solid to get in, solid to get out, and they're built to withstand the same crashes that would happen in the front seat or the middle seat, too.
And they do have seat belts?
They do have seat belts now. It had since, I think my first Suburban was 94, 95, and they had them then. And I've been buying them since then. I usually have a Suburban in the family with a lot of kids.
Senator Monroe.
Well, Mr. Chair, my wife drives an 8-passenger Honda Odyssey, and it has 8 seat belts.
So there.
So you can't have 9 people in the car?
No.
This passes. Okay.
Was it?
Did that get at your question?
Well, I want to go down and check out my own Suburban. So I mean,
but Senator Byers and Senator Girard, if it was required at the time of manufacture, it's exempt.
That's right.
Well, the real issue is
that doesn't
you
really
can't
exempt you from liability, but go ahead.
Yeah, it does this. Okay. Thank you both.
Thank you.
All righty. We're in work session. Senator Monroe, do you have a motion?
I would be happy to move Senate Bill 495 to the 4th Senate floor with a due pass recommendation, and I'd even be happy to help Doc Bates carry it if he wants me to.
Discussion on the motion. Is there opposition to the motion?
I might be a no on the floor.
But you're a yes, then?
Oh, I'll bite my tongue.
So, Senate Bill 495 moves to the Senate floor with...
I'm a no.
You're a no.
Yeah.
Senator Thompson is a no.
Well, then I'll join my colleague.
Apparently we have two no's. Senator Thompson and Senator Girard are no's. Okay. And Senator Bates, would you like to carry along with Senator Monroe?
Yes.
That might be a yes on the floor.
Do you want to say you might be a yes on the floor, too?
I'll be a no on the floor.
Okay. All right, we're closing on that one. Now we can go back up and pick up Senate Bill. We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 271.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 271 increases maximum rate of assessment paid by freight railroads operating in Oregon, modified standard for state safety oversight program for rail fixed guideway system, declares emergency effective on passage. We have a dash 2 amendment, removes increases of maximum rate of assessment paid by freight railroads operating in Oregon, clarifies modifications for standards for rail fixed guideway systems to align with recently published federal standards. With that dash 2 amendment, there is no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact.
Yeah, let's see. Hal Gard and Claudia Keith. Can get you both up, I guess. Oh, sure.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Hal Gard. I am the Rail and Public Transit Administrator for the Oregon Department of Transportation. Just very quickly, the Dash 2 amended Senate Bill 271 just brings our existing state safety oversight program for fixed guideway transit, in other words, light rail, streetcar, and trolley systems, into compliance with current federal law, which maintains, not only does it strengthen the safety program considerably, but it also maintains our ability to receive Federal Transit Administration funding as a state.
It's an important feature. Questions of help? Don't see any. Ma'am?
Chair Beyer and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Claudia Keith, representing the League of Women Voters, Oregon, and we support this bill. And rather than reading my testimony related to oil safety, rail safety, that I wrote earlier, I just want to remind the committee that the League has a position on preserving the physical, chemical, and biological integrity of the ecosystem with the maximum protection of the public health and the environment, with a focus on demanding pollution prevention. Additionally, the League's social policy is very clear: secure equal rights, equal opportunity for all, and promote social and economic justice and the health and safety of all Americans. We're concerned about ensuring there's appropriate safety and appropriate funding related to that safety, having to do with rail, specifically having to do with rail and oil and other fossil fuels. So again, we support this bill, and thank you for.
Thank you. Questions? Seeing none, thank you very much. All righty, that's all I had signed up, so we will move. The chair moves the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 271. Discussion on the motion?
What does the Dash 2 do again?
Would you repeat the Dash 2s, please?
It removes increases of maximum rate of assessment paid by freight railroads operating in Oregon. It also clarifies modifications for standards for rail fixed guideway systems to align with recently published federal standards.
Takes the fee out and aligns with the feds.
Okay.
Questions? Is there any opposition to the Dash 2 amendments? There is none. The Dash 2s are adopted. The chair moves Senate Bill 271 as amended by the Dash 2s to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion on that motion. Seeing none, is there any opposition to the motion? Senate Bill 271 is amended by the Dash 2s is moved to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there someone who wants to carry that? Oh, I'll carry it. All right, now we'll flip the page and I don't remember this one, so we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 879.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 879, we heard in committee just last week. We do have three amendments for this bill. The original measure exempts attorneys and real estate licensees from requirement to obtain mortgage loan originator's license in order to perform activities of a mortgage loan originator. Specifies that residential mortgage loan is a loan for personal, family, or household purposes that is secured by mortgage, trust deed, or equivalent consequential security interest on dwelling or residential real property upon which dwelling is or is intended to be constructed. The last amendment that has come in is the Dash 4 amendment, which we discussed during our last meeting. It replaces the original measure. It exempts attorneys that negotiate the terms of residential mortgage loan in the attorney's representation of a client that buys or sells a dwelling unit. On that Dash 4 amendment, there is no revenue and no fiscal impact.
So to be clear, the Dash 4s are a gut and stuff.
Correct.
Come on down.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Sean Jillians today representing the Oregon Association of Realtors in support of the Dash 4 amendments. James did a great job giving you a summary of them. They are gut and stuff. They make about five words change, just clarifying the exemption for attorneys when they're representing people who are participating in seller financing transactions. Appreciate the work of Senator Brzezinski and the department in sort of getting something that we can move forward. And on the House side, potentially we'll look at additional amendments, but we're good with the Dash 4s as they are. Happy to answer any questions on the technical part.
Questions? Real quick, it's a gut and stuff. Okay. Do the department have any issues? No issues. All righty. Let's see. The chair moves the Dash 4 amendments to Senate Bill 879. Discussion? No discussion on the motion. Is there any opposition to the motion? There is none. The Dash 4s are adopted. So the chair moves Senate Bill 879 as amended by the Dash 4s to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Discussion on that. Is there any opposition? Seeing none. Senate Bill 879 as amended by the Dash 4s is moved to the Senate floor with a do pass recommendation. Brzezinski work on this? Should we ask him to? We'll ask him to carry it. See if he will. Okay, so we'll close on that. And now we're into tax credits. Do you have those memos? Or?
Yep, I've distributed them.
Okay. So we'll start off with Senate Bill 4. Yeah, excuse me, getting my tongue tied up here. Senate Bill 45. And colleagues, what we're going to do here, you have a list of amendments, is just see where you're at on the various ones.
These all have to go to the...
They all have to go to the... our purpose is to decide whether we're going to move them or not to this tax, the Joint Tax Credit Committee,
right,
and a recommendation. I've asked James to go through the form that describes the impact and all of that, so we'll let him kind of take us through each one, and then we can decide what we want to do with it.
Mr. Chair, if I may, before we start, I sit on that committee, and one of the rules that we discussed during that committee was if there's no action on these, they go to it without recommendation.
They go forward without a recommendation. Okay. All right, James?
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 45, it extends sunset for tax credit for qualified equity investment from July 1st, 2016 to July 1st, 2022. There is a Dash 1 amendment, but the Dash 1 amendment is no longer needed. Okay. As you see on the first page of the memo there, the first paragraph and the first sentence of the first paragraph is the traditional or usual recommendation that would go with one of these tax credits. So as for an example there, that first sentence, it talks about that we've heard this bill and concluded that, for example, the tax credit should be extended because the preliminary results seem promising and more time is needed for definitive results. One of the things that the revenue report talked about this tax credit was that it was just enacted in 2011, and because of the graduated credit deployment, no tax credits are allowed for the first 2 years. So this tax credit is still being processed by the state, and the investments are still coming out. In addition to that, which was taken care of in these other questions, there are a series of mixed results about what this tax credit has done in Oregon, and quite frankly, the results are still coming out about the return on investment on the tax credit. But according to Business Oregon, there are a number of projects which have taken advantage of the tax credit as well. The other key element to this tax credit is that it is able to take advantage of a federal program, and so it couples a couple of things together in order to make investments in low-income communities more attractive. I would say that's a high-level overview of what the tax credit is doing.
Okay.
How much does it cost? I know you said that it's hard to tell because what is the estimate that it's going to be down the road?
The maximum amount of tax credits that would be claimed by all Oregon taxpayers is $16
million. It's a very strange animal. It ties to the federal one. I'll get this wrong. It's a five-year tax credit over a seven-year period, and it doesn't start until the third year.
Correct.
So we have some, but I'm not sure if any of them. In fact, I guess by definition, since we haven't passed more than 2 years ago, none of them have effectively taken effect yet.
Correct. It's a program that hasn't come to fruition, one could argue, and so the results are hard to measure. The other thing that was interesting out of the tax report is that there are a number of other states that have something very similar to this. And Oregon's cap, which is the $16 million, is one of the lowest ones compared to other states. For example, Arkansas, its cap is $166 million, and Nevada's cap is $200 million. So it's interesting.
Well, the hard part about this for Senator Riley and his colleagues on the Tax Credit Committee is you've got something like $62 million in credits expiring and only $14 million that you can renew.
Correct. Mr. Chair, I would recommend that we pass this along with no recommendation.
All right.
I agree.
What's your sense?
Well, I would recommend it, but I mean, I've always been on the downside of things here.
Senator Thompson, where are you at?
I'm right here.
So if we
I'm good with that.
So, Senator Riley, am I correct then from what you said is if we take no action, it automatically moves forward with no recommendation?
That's correct.
It sounds like that is the will of the committee, so we will let that happen then. We will close on that, and let's open the work session on 52.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 52. Extends sunset on corporate tax offset of insurer assessment from January 1st, 2016 to January 1st, 2020. One of the things with this one is that the subsequent referral was left off of this Senate bill, so we need to add the JTAX subsequent referral to this one when we make a decision on it. If you look at the first paragraph again and the first sentence, a draft sentence could be constructed to say that the tax credit should be continued due to its infrequent use, low cost, and benefit to insurance beneficiaries. The tax revenue report talked extensively about how this this assessment hasn't been used in quite a number of years in the last, especially the last few years, and in that the tax credit is actually quite low as well. And with that being said, one of the benefits here is that it would theoretically hold down and insurance costs because of that safety net that is built in, because all insurance carriers are mandated in order to pay into the Oregon Life and Health Insurance Guarantee Association. The other thing that was interesting about the tax credit is that we're the only state that has a similar tax credit to this.
But it hasn't been used for years?
Correct.
And it costs next
several month. Years.
Huh? It doesn't cost anything, or anything.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I think it's a good deal. For the return on the investment, I think it's a pretty good deal.
So your recommendation is to move it with recommendation?
Yeah.
So you want to make that in the form of a motion?
Sure. I move Senate Bill 52 goes to the...
Joint Committee on Tax Credits.
Well, does that go right to that committee, or does it go to the floor first?
No, it goes right to the committee.
Okay. I move Senate Bill 52... go to be referred to the tax credit committee with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Girard has moved the recommendation on Senate Bill 52 to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits with a, I guess it would be a due continue.
it's a due pass. You were to do that, yeah.
Okay.
I'm going to be a no on the due pass, but...
Okay.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I would prefer that we did the same thing we did with the other one, just let it move without recommendation. I will be a no on this motion.
Okay. I will tell you, colleagues, that we do have an admonition from the Senate President that we're supposed to make recommendations, which is in conflict with what the committee has said. So you're no?
I'm a no.
And you're no?
Mm-hmm.
I will be a yes. Senator Thompson?
Mm-hmm. I'll be yes.
So the recommendation on Senate Bill 52 to move to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits with a due pass recommendation is adopted with Senators Riley and Monroe in opposition. We'll close on that one.
You have to fill out the form, Chair.
Huh?
Now you have to fill out the form.
I think we have it filled out. That's what these are.
It's all filled out?
Yeah.
Like that. File notice on possible minority reports on 596 and Bill 275. Just
okay.
To let you know.
Take note of those.
Thanks.
596.
596 and 275.
And we are open on Senate Bill 801 with the dash twos, it appears.
Mr. Chair?
Go ahead.
Are we open for discussion? Go ahead and ask someone
okay. first. So these last two tax credit bills, Senate Bill 801 and 872, are a little bit different animal than Senate Bill 45 and
They're
52 because it doesn't have the sunset clause to it, but we grouped all these tax credit bills for commonality of subject area. So Senate Bill 801 is a proposal for a new tax credit that we heard back in March that Senator Farioli has suggested. What the measure does, it creates credit against income tax for taxpayers that create 10 or more new jobs during tax year, applies to tax years beginning on or after January 1st, 2016, takes effect 90 days after sine die. We do have a dash 2 amendment, which changes the tax credit to $1,000 per job, requires jobs to earn above the community average wage to be eligible for tax credit, limits the tax credit to businesses with 100 or fewer employees. We have a revenue light statement and then a fiscal impact statement for this as well, being $190,000 for two FTEs to administer the credit. And so the memo that's there takes similar questions for bills or for tax credits that would be sunsetted and tries to apply them to this proposed tax credit to give a little bit of comparing
context.
Oranges to oranges and context.
Discussion. Senator Riley.
So this one is a new tax credit. If we take no action, this one dies, so it doesn't go on. If we take no action, this one does not go to the tax credit committee because it's a new one.
Okay. Discussion, Senator Monroe.
Well, I'm a little skeptical of whether an employer would decide to hire new people for a $1,000 credit unless he needed those new people, in which case he would hire them anyway.
It's an incentive for small business. So I think it's a really nice tax credit, but given the question will be for them to decide if we can afford it or not.
Yeah. This is very much parallel to a program that used to exist. I don't know if it does anymore for the state, for the federal. It's called the Targeted Jobs Tax Credit Act, which gave actually a lot richer than this. I think they gave like a $10,000 tax credit or something. But again, it's going to be one that I'm not sure that with $14 billion out of 64 expiring, it's going to be tough down there.
But if we send it down, then they at least have the option.
So you want to send it with no recommendation?
Well, if that's the only way to do it, I'd like to do that, yeah.
Is that a motion?
I could send it with a recommendation, but I don't think it'll pass.
No.
Okay, I'll send Senate Bill 801 to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits with no recommendation.
Okay.
We have a motion to send Senate Bill 801 as amended by the dash twos, right?
As amended by the dash twos.
To the Joint Tax Credit Committee with no recommendation. Is there any discussion on that? It's adopted, so we'll close on that, and we'll take up
872.
Open the work session on Senate Bill 872, and that has a dash one amendment.
Correct, Mr. Chair. So, committee members, Senate Bill 872 with the dash one amendment includes language that allows the Oregon Business Development Department to reimburse a local production service company for a portion of actual expenses incurred by filmmaker or local media production services company in Oregon. There is a revenue light statement and no fiscal impact with the dash one amendment. Looking at that memo for Senate Bill 872-1, this one's even a little bit different than Senate Bill 4552 and Senate Bill 801, just because this is an increase of a tax credit. And we took the same questions and applied it to this tax credit as well. It's not sunsetting. Again, it's an increase. I think one of the highlights of this memo is the second question, second paragraph, which is the last paragraph on the first page, where it says for fiscal years 2013 to 2014, $135 million of in-state spending was directly tracked through this through the film program and tax credit, which is detailed in this report. And if you have any other questions about the highlight of this tax credit, the memo might address it. And then I see people in the audience here from the film department that is advocating for the tax credit or the increase in tax credit.
Mr. Chair.
Question? Yes, Senator.
Yeah, this one I like, and I'd be happy to move it whenever you're ready.
Well, I don't know if others have comments. This is an industry that I have some familiarity with, and I will tell you that it's one. We have a number of TV shows in Portland right now. I think there are three or four of them up there. You will absolutely not get a production if you don't have a tax credit.
But this is a
program of some sort. Actually, the amount of it is rather insignificant, but having it or not having it is very significant.
What is it?
Yes.
But as pointed out, this doesn't do away with the tax credit if we vote no. This is an increase in the tax credit.
That's
at
correct.
At a time when they don't have any money. So there's a heck of a lot of good tax credits down there, and I just don't think we should be increasing the tax credit at a time when we're decreasing overall tax credits. And you know,
it's increasing the amount.
Yeah. Well,
and because it's all spent.
And this one, Mr. Chair, if I may, is very similar. If we do nothing, it stays the way it is and doesn't go to the committee. If we pass it, it goes to the committee and they make a decision on the increase, or could even get rid of it.
Senator Merle, did you have a motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 872 to the Special Tax Credit Committee, whatever it's called, with the due pass recommendation.
As amended by the dash ones.
Pardon?
As amended by the dash ones.
As amended by the dash one.
Discussion on the motion.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I'm convinced we're in competition with a number of other states, and the people that make films and television shows and so on really like coming to Oregon, but unless we give them at least a bit of an incentive, they're going to go to New Mexico or someplace else. So this is a jobs bill, if there ever was one. For every dollar that they spend in Oregon, there are many jobs created. So it's something we need to do.
It is one, Senator Monroe, that the dollar has to be spent first before they get the credit.
Yes, that's true.
Discussion. Is there opposition? Senator Girard is in opposition. Senator Thompson, are you okay?
Yeah, I think I'm going to make it.
Okay.
Almost done.
I believe, which one are we on? Senate Bill 872, as amended by the Dash Ones, is moved to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits with a do-pass recommendation. And colleagues, that was painful, but we got through the committee. We got through it. Not sure that how well this process works, but James, you did an excellent job of doing all these. So we are closed on the last bill, and we are closed and done with Senate bills.
Way to go.
We are adjourned.
One of the few
Senate bills.
Way to go.
We are adjourned.
One of the few.